Connect the Dots with Allison Rose Levy, Saturdays at noon Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and we're here with you every Saturday at noon Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm a Huffington Post blogger and a health journalist for over 20 years, and I also conduct this radio program, and our goal is to connect our concerns for our personal health with our total health environment. That includes the health of our communities, the health of our society, and the health of the earth. Today, I'm really delighted to have a terrific guest on the show, someone I've long admired. She is Sandra Steingraber, the author of numerous books, including the recent Raising Elijah. Before we go to the conversation with Sandra, I just want to point listeners this week to a few websites where you can go to participate in activism. Our highlighted actions this week and this next couple of weeks are to preserve the water of the North Mid-Atlantic region through keeping fracking out of New York State as well as out of the Delaware River. We'll be talking more about that in our interview because that's something that Sandra Steingraber also cares about passionately. But I just want to give you all a clue of how you can tune in and participate in some ongoing actions and events because our voices really, really do have power. We are not just kind of helplessly to stand by or ignore this problem because we're afraid we can't have influence on the legislative and executive officials who are, you know, in the process of sort of decision and debate around whether the Northeast will be fracked, which brings toxic chemicals. We'll talk more about those risks in our program. But for those who are interested in participating, we do action on every show. I urge you to go to DamascusCitizens.org as well as WaterDefense.org and CatskillCitizens.org, where you can tune in to upcoming actions, more information, and participate in this very crucial time window. So thank you. If you have any questions about those organizations, you can also find them on my website, healthjournalistblog.com. So now I am so delighted and honored to welcome to Connect the Dots, Sandra Steingraber. Welcome, Sandra.
Well, thanks for having me.
I've been, a huge fan of your work for some time, your most recent book, Raising Elijah, it really calls the question on what we're the choices we make now and how they affect the next generation. And this really can and should be, you're a mom, you have two kids, it's a motivating factor for you, as I feel it should be for everybody of all generations. What is it that we're doing in our time? I mean, one of the things that was really incredibly poignant, I have to say that Sandra and I were both at a rally in Trenton, New Jersey this past week, which was originally to have brought people to intervene or to watch as the Delaware River Basin Commission was scheduled to make a terrible decision to frack in the Delaware River Basin, which brings water to millions of people. Fortunately, that was stalled. We don't know when it will resume, but Sandra gave such a beautifully moving talk talking about our children, and you know there were little school children who saw this event, and when they heard what it was about, the looks of concern on their faces were so poignant. I mean, this next generation is facing something that I don't think we didn't have to face it as kids, or if we were facing it, we didn't know we were facing it. Let's talk first about the children and what all of the toxic chemicals, including those in fracking, mean to them, to their future, to their health.
Yeah, great. Okay. Well, Raising Elijah is my most recent book, and as you suggest, I wrote it not only as a biologist who's been studying environmental public health for 20 years, but also as a mother now myself, who realized that I'm a conscientious parent, but I'm not a HEPA filter, right? I can't put my body in between my children's body and the various hormone-disrupting and cancer-causing chemicals that are allowed to circulate in our air, food, and water. For that, we need a whole new regulatory system, which sounds overwhelming, and it sounds like a task that most busy parents can't take up. But it turns out that that task of divorcing ourselves from inherently toxic chemicals is the same task as getting us off of fossil fuels, which is threatening to tank our climate system, because most of the chemicals that are toxic actually come to us from petroleum, natural gas, and coal. So it turns out that even though this is a huge problem, it's a very simple one. It means divorcing our economy from a ruinous dependency on fossil fuels. And I titled the book Raising Elijah, which is because my son, who's 10 and has asthma, and couldn't live in New York State if fracking comes here and blankets us with a smog of asthma-inducing air pollutants. Elijah himself is named after an abolitionist hero of mine, Elijah Lovejoy. So in the book, I try to draw out a lot of connections between our situation now, and I do see fracking here in the Northeast as the civil rights issue of our time and for the generation of children of which my kids are a part. But I see a strong connection between what's happening now and abolitionism as it was being suggested in the 1830s, which was a time when our economy was ruinously dependent on slave labor, and there were many investments in slaves, a lot of personal wealth bound up in slaves. It was considered a property issue. It allowed our economy to have a lower cost of living. It kept the price of goods low. It made us competitive in the world market. And investing in slaves in the 1830s was a little like investing in real estate in the 1990s, right? But nevertheless, the early abolitionists were standing up and saying, so what? Even though all those things are true, there's a more fundamental principle at stake here, and that is that slavery is a homicidal abomination and it just needs to end. And those people were considered so far beyond the pale, you know. So there was a big debate at the time about whether we could regulate slavery, whether, you know, Kansas could be half free, half slave, whether we could return runaway slaves or whether they were free. So there were those who wanted to regulate slavery. There were those who wanted things to stay the way they were and be pro-slavery. And then there were very few people that said, you know, you can't regulate something that's fundamentally wrong. It just has to end, and we have to redesign our whole economy. And that group of people won out, ultimately, and those are the heroes, right? And so I want us to be the heroes of our time, because the environmental crisis is the human rights crisis of our time, and I want us to stand up and say we need to abolitionists for fossil fuels and divorce our economy on its ruinous dependency. The best science shows us that it's possible. So here in the Northeast, that larger battle to get rid of inherently toxic chemicals, which also means getting rid of chemicals that are increasing the instability of our climate and threatening the ecology of which our children's lives depend, that battle is centered around fracking, this newish technique that was developed in the West where very few people live, but now is being brought into places like New York, which is our third most populous state, and is the proposal is to practice this in places where lots of people live. And, of course, the Delaware River Basin, if we drill there and blow up the bedrock and pump it full of toxic chemicals, what we're doing is practicing an extreme form of fossil fuel extraction in the river basin that actually provides drinking water for 5% of the American people. So it's an enormous battle with huge stakes.
Yeah, that's incredible. I mean, I love the notion that we are, in effect, I mean, we consider ourselves dependent, and the notion of using gas is to ostensibly create independence, but actually it's a continuation of an enslavement, is as you so aptly describe. And if we go and trust in our capacity to, you know, the supposed American creative engineering initiative and all of that creativity and pioneering spirit that we have, if we go in that direction and invest in these newer renewable technologies for energy, it's an economic opportunity, and it's really a life and planetary saving direction for us, and freedom from enslavement. So this claim that, you know, that gas is somehow conferring independence is actually a PR mischaracterization of what's happening. And I just want to say as well, I know that there may be new listeners tuning in to hear you on this program, Sandra, but also on Connect the Dots, I think I must have done 10 to a dozen different programs on fracking with, with a whole range of community leaders on a range of facets of this as well. So I'm really, really, so I think my listenership is pretty acquainted with the issue. What I'd like to get your special expertise weighing in on is, the science. Because one of the things that's said is, here is your mention, we're taking an enormous step to, risk exposing a sizable population in major urban centers in the Northeast to something. So the gas companies will say in their multi-million dollar PR, and then you have a group of activist grassroots organizations, kind of speaking up and offering other information. But they will say, for example, that it's safe, that it can be done safely. There's no science, although gas has been, the chemicals have been shown to migrate quite extensively to water supplies and people's wells. They will often say, well, there's no scientific proof. You can't prove that this came from there to you, and you can't prove this, and you can't prove that. And where do we stand on the science? Since you're a biologist, maybe you can really clue our listeners in.
Sure. So I've turned my attention full time to understanding fracking about 2 years ago, and have been looking at the data on these questions ever since. And so what I can say is that the science is incomplete. The science is emerging. What the data we have now is troubling. It's far from absolute proof. But the issues are these. We don't have a spare planet to try fracking out on. Normally when we propose to do something inherently dangerous, like introduce a new chemical onto the market, we would drag it into the laboratory and test it. But you can't test fracking in lab. You can only test it on the only planet that we have. And then wait to see what happens. And because fracking is new, and I want to be clear about that, because one of the fig leaves that the gas industry says is that we've been doing this for 60 years, we have not been doing the kind of gas extraction practice, slick water, high volume, horizontal hydrofracking, which is what fracking refers to. We haven't been doing that for very long at all. And the first horizontal hydrofract well here in the Northeast was from 2004. And so what we need to do then is look at the data we have available to us now and ask ourselves, in the face of scientific uncertainties, Where does benefit of the doubt belong? Does it belong to public health, or does it belong to things that threaten public health? And the purpose of public health is actually not just to study and measure pollution in people after they've been exposed. It's actually to make very good, our best prediction based on the evidence we have to us now. So in other words, here in New York State, we actually stopped a cholera epidemic in the 19th century that really devastated London and places in Europe. And we did it because we noticed that there was a correlation between open sewer systems and cholera. And we didn't know why. And some people thought it was because, open sewer systems tended to be in slums. People in slums tended to be alcoholics, and maybe alcoholism and unemployment were the cause of cholera. But other people correctly said, no, it's not bad lifestyle. It's these open sewers. And so anyway, closed sewer systems were put in place, and we solved the cholera epidemic. We had no idea why it worked. 50 years later, we discovered that a fecal-borne bacteria caused cholera. That was the mechanism, that causative agent. But in fact, insisting on deep burial of the dead and closed sewer systems kept basically human shit from getting in the drinking water, to speak bluntly. And yet, because we were willing to have the courage, our public health officials of the day had the courage to act on good but partial information, we prevented sickness and death. Similarly with tobacco, right? In 1964, we had some correlative evidence, troubling evidence, linking smoking with lung cancer. We didn't know why or how, but the Surgeon General had the courage to act on good but partial evidence and warn people that smoking caused cancer, even though there was not absolute proof at the time, and that people should stop smoking and not start smoking. Now, I was 5 years old at the time, and my parents, my mom, who was also a biologist, decided that if smoking caused cancer, probably it was not good for kids to be exposed to secondhand smoke. So even though I grew up as that generation who was probably, as a kid, exposed to more secondhand smoke than anybody else, because the 60s was the height of smoking in the United States in terms of percentage of adults who were smokers. The early 60s was the peak. And I was a kid then, but I was always protected. My parents never let people smoke around my kids or me or let anyone smoke in our house, even though I had all these smoking aunts and uncles, because my mom made a guess, you know, based on good but partial evidence that, look, tobacco smoke looks inherently toxic. I don't think it's good to have it around my kids. And so I was actually protected. So that's the same, out of that spirit of public health is offers us a lot of wisdom as to how to move forward here with fracking. The evidence that we have so far is that at least 1,000 different wells have been contaminated with substances that we know are used in fracking. Is it possible that some of those wells had those chemicals in it from other reasons? Yeah, sure. But the best conclusion, the most reasonable conclusion, and there's a saying in science that if you hear hoofbeats, think horses, you don't think zebras, right? The most reasonable conclusion is that the chemicals that are used in fracking operations nearby are the cause of the water contamination. And that is enough for me as a scientist to say, number one, we need to study this a lot more. But number two, in the meantime, let's get people out of harm's way. The wheels of science grind very slowly, and the science should go on, and we have plenty of gas patches where we could declare moratoria and then study the underlying geology and hydrology. You know, we've got plenty of unintended experiments already going on. So let's stop everything, study this, and then if it does turn out to be safe, and there is a demonstration of safety, then maybe we can consider making this part of our energy plan. I'm pretty sure that's not going to be the outcome. So that's why, as a biologist, based on the troubling evidence that we have now, I have thrown my hat in the ring with the activists who have said we need to ban fracking, and we need to just stop and take a look at the human health costs before we do anything more. So benefit of the doubt goes to kids, not the things that threaten kids.
That makes, so, you know, you're actually saying let's not, through giving the benefit of the doubt in the wrong direction, become the victims of negative consequences that haven't
well,
been
it's a,
proven
it's a
against.
Human rights abuse,
you know.
Right? If there is no demonstration of safety, then if we go forward, we're essentially enrolling all of the population of the Northeast, everyone in the Delaware River Basin, everyone who lives in New York State, to an uncontrolled human experiment, where we're all going to be potentially exposed to the chemicals involved with fracking, and then somewhere 20 or 30 years from now, we're going to study the results. I don't want to sign up for that experiment. I don't want my kids to be data points in that experiment. And when you practice an inherently dangerous, extreme, carcinogen-dependent fossil fuel extraction method in a place where millions of people live, you're conducting an experiment without consent, and that's just morally wrong. Now, I felt so strongly about that when I became this year the lucky recipient of the Heinz Award, which is an award given to environmental scientists for recognition of their work. So this year I was one of the recipients, and so just went down to Washington with 9 other environmental scientists to be bestowed my Heinz Medal and pick up a check for $100,000. You know, it comes with this unrestricted cash prize. And the kind of the traditional thing that other of my colleagues who have previously won this award do with their money, which is a wonderful thing, is to devote it to their work, to devote it to the research that gives us this very important evidence. But I've decided to do something a little bit different because I feel like this is such an emergency and there's such a sense of urgency around fracking that I'm actually, instead of using that money to further my own research agenda, I'm donating it to the anti-fracking movement in here in upstate New York, where we're drawing a line in the sand and standing up to say no to lifting the moratorium that we've all enjoyed. And my hope in doing this is that it becomes a kind of reverse gesture to what I've seen happening all around me here in upstate New York, which is that big checks are issued by the gas industry to individual landowners in exchange for their silence and their complicity in bringing fracking to upstate New York. And then we, all of us who are the neighbors of those folks, are exposed to the smog, the noise, the light at night. We all get our bedrock blown up, whether we want it or not. So we've seen the effects of big checks being issued to individual people and on the community. I'm interested in the reverse gesture. What if I took a big check and pushed it out into the community? I'm hoping it inspires and emboldens others to bring what they can to the fracking abolitionist movement, which I see as the kind of civil rights movement of our time. So it's a great honor right now to be part of this movement. I always felt like if I lived in the 1830s, I would have, you know, been part of the Underground Railroad. That sounds so heroic and so exciting. But this is the Underground Railroad here of our time. And if you want to be a hero, you know, here's your chance. This is an amazingly smart and savvy and swiftly growing movement, and ultimately the movement is saying natural gas is not a bridge to the future, it's a wall, and renewable energy, the best science shows us that we could end our ruinous dependency on fossil fuels within 20 years if we were willing to cut our energy consumption by half. That's the challenge. And that's what, you know, we want to build a bridge to that future. And investing in this industrial build-out here in rural upstate New York is only a distraction at best, and certainly keeps investment dollars away from the things that we know are the way to the future.
You know, I agree with you, and I thank you for the gesture, which is really quite meaningful. Actually, in my upcoming Huffington blog, I quote Audrey McClendon, who is the CEO of Chesapeake Gas, that has been the industry leader in the development of this new form of extraction. And he characterizes the grassroots groups as being well-funded, which is pretty funny because Forbes magazine, one of their writers was spending time and interviewing him and reported that he was drinking $20,000 bottles of wine, you know, so five meals, you know, where he has a bottle of wine that costs that, and he calls the activists well-funded, but the activists, I'm sure, and I speak among them as well, are very grateful for what you're saying. What you're doing and really putting the money on the line in that way to really help. The other thing that I do want to emphasize, too, and ask you about is, I am a downstater. I'm a native New York City resident, and I personally, you know, as someone who's reported on health and science, I feel that we are living downstream, and this is the title of your earlier book, and a film was made of it as well. There's some kind of sense of disconnect, no matter how, you know, we New Yorkers may say that, you know, we like to eat healthy food from the farmer's market, we're health-oriented, we want to build community gardens in the city and rooftop gardens, and yet there's a sense of disconnect with the larger rural environments north of us, from which our water flow, from which much of our sustainable agriculture comes, agriculture that, if poisoned by fracking chemicals, would be very hard to replicate in rooftop gardens. So I would like you to paint a picture for the downstate city residents who may just feel that this is an upstate problem that doesn't concern them. You know, what are the risk factors and concerns for those living downstream from where these activities would happen if they go forward, for those living in large urban environments like New York and Philadelphia?
Sure. First of all, I guess New York City does sometimes seem like a nation state unto itself. But my conversations with Manhattan residents in particular, I think I've been impressed with how they understand those connections. And for example, like one of the things I think I can bring to that conversation is a lot of research I've done on air pollution and its impacts on health, especially ozone. That's one of the chemicals I know a lot about. And so one of the things that I'm interested in talking about is the way that upstate New York is not just the drinking fountain for New York City. And I think there is a high degree of understanding of that, right, that all of this beautiful, unfiltered tap water that New Yorkers are so proud of come from the Catskill Mountain areas through these aqueducts, and also through the Delaware River Basin. So there's a lot of understanding and appreciation for that. But the upstate New York is not just a drinking fountain for downstaters. It's also the lungs. So all of the air here in rural upstate New York, as well as in Pennsylvania, blows west to east, the prevailing winds, and pushes out a lot of the vehicular exhaust and the air pollution that would otherwise make Manhattan essentially unlivable, and pushes all that out to sea. So we in upstate who live west of Manhattan and the other boroughs, we are providing fresh air on a daily basis. So we know that the plan to bring fracking to upstate New York involves a build-out of 62,000 gas wells. That's the kind of master plan. And each one of those gas wells will require 1,000 different truck trips to bring all the fresh water and the chemicals to the well, and those chemicals and water then are used as a essentially as a club to smash the bedrock apart. And then from each wellhead will be vented all kinds of toxic vapors, which are the other hydrocarbons that are not the natural gas, that are contaminants in the natural gas. So there's a kind of toluene, benzene, and all kinds of things that kind of come up that are released from the wellheads. And those combine with the diesel exhaust from all the trucks that will be filling the roads to create smog. And that kind of urban smog we know is created in gas patches when we take a look at air quality indices in places where fracking has been practiced for a while now, for example in Wyoming and Utah. So there, and those places we started off with actually pristine air quality, and there's no other industry there. We're talking about very remote and rural places, and not a lot of people there. And yet what the air quality indices show, and this was a surprise to a lot of us in the scientific community, in a very short period of time after gas drilling started, the ground level ozone was higher than what we saw in downtown LA. So you could start with pristine air, and within a few years of fracking build-out, end up with ozone non-attainment, meaning ozone levels that we know cause human health problems, including increased asthma among children, stroke, heart attack. Ozone is also implicated in the spread of cancer. In other words, ozone is not a carcinogen per se, but it increases the chances that if you have a tumor somewhere, you will get lung metastasis, because it increases the stickiness and the inflammation in lung tissue and makes it more likely that an errant cancer cell would be able to set up shop there. So we already have these problems in the Uinta area of Utah and in Wyoming. Here in upstate New York, we already have an ozone problem. We're not starting with pristine air. I don't think that's news to anybody. Even our rural areas of our state here in upstate New York, we're on the tailpipe end of the Ohio Valley. So we're already getting emissions from the coal-burning power plants of Ohio and a lot of the industries in Pennsylvania. And so we struggle already with ozone days, bad air days in the summer. So if we blanket the area with 62,000 gas wells and you do 62,000 times 1,000 trucks, that's a lot of zeros, and you add that number of truck trips to our roads, you add compressor stations and condenser stations, all those things also run on diesel, you're going to end up with air that is, when it blows into Harlem, is going to add to all the vehicular exhaust there already and will almost surely increase the rate of asthma among kids, raise the risk for heart attack and stroke, lung cancer, bladder cancer, breast cancers, and all the other cancers that go along with air pollution. And this is almost a certainty. Now, what's interesting to me as a scientist about the environmental impact statement that New York State has generated, which is going to serve as the green light for lifting the moratoria, if in fact that's the route we go, this so-called supplemental generic environmental impact statement, the SGEIS, that we hear so much about, does not contain a human health assessment. So that's one of my big messages here, that it's a 1,500-page document. It weighs 15 pounds. You know, it's three reams of paper. Mm-hmm. And the word carcinogen appears only 10 times in those 1,500 pages. The word children appears not at all. And it contains no comprehensive human health assessment, which is what Governor Patterson called for when he issued the moratorium. He said, you know, fracking cannot go forward until we understand the effects on the environment and on the health of the people who live here. And yet, that two drafts later, that's not been done, which is why fracking should not go forward, and this draft environmental impact statement should simply be withdrawn. And the fact is that we can run the numbers on air pollution. We know there are a lot of uncertainties about the water pollution. But with air pollution, we in the scientific community have such good knowledge about how much pollution is generated from certain kinds of practices, from diesel engines, from compressor stations that make formaldehyde and so on. We know how much nitric oxides combined with how much VOCs equals how much ozone. We could actually come up with a number for how much excess ozone would be created if we opened New York up to fracking. And then we could continue and transform that data into projections about how many excess asthma cases in kids, how many more bronchitis, how many more heart attacks, stroke. We could run all those numbers, and we could monetize it. We could say, this is how much money we would add to how many more medical expenses we would add to Medicare and Medicaid, how much health insurance premiums would go up, how many more hospital emergency room visits, how many more school absenteeism days by kids who have asthma, how much lost productivity. And those data could be used, those costs could be weighed against the so-called benefits from tax revenues and jobs that fracking might bring. But we can't do that kind of analysis, the risk-benefit analysis, because the costs in human health have never been generated, even though we have the tools to do that. So that's been my main message when I've testified before the New York State Assembly and offered comment before the Department of Environmental Conservation in the ongoing hearings, that without a human health assessment, there's no way we can balance benefits against costs here, because we haven't quantified the costs. We haven't even considered them at all, qualified them, let alone put a dollar value on them.
Well, that's really that's a pretty major oversight, and one that should be worrying to anyone who cares about health in this region. We're going to have to take a break now for station identification here on Connect the Dots, and we'll be back in just a few minutes. Please stay with us, listeners. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and I'm talking with Sandra Steingraber, the author of Raising Elijah. Welcome back, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and we're with you every Saturday at noon on Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I also want to encourage you to listen to our show archives. We have some wonderful guests who've appeared on the show, including in recent weeks, Dr. Ricky Ott speaking about the impacts of the Gulf oil spill on health, Leslie Manoukian, the producer of the documentary The Greater Good, offering a balanced look at vaccines, Bill McKibben talking about tar sands, and on today's show, I'm so thrilled to have with us Sandra Steingraber, the author of Raising Elijah, as well as several other books that are really Bibles for people who care about linking our understanding of our health with that of the environment. Having Faith, An Ecologist's Journey to Motherhood is one of her books, as is Living Downstream, An Ecologist's Personal Investigation of Cancer and environment. You can find out more about her work and her upcoming activities on her website, steingraber.com, S-T-E-I-N-G-R-A-B-E-R. And you can sign up for announcements of future radio programs, actions, as well as my Huffington blogs at healthjournalistblog.com. So these are all ways to sort of stay connected, become informed, and take action and move forward. So Sandra, in the last segment of the show, you were talking about the fact that the guidelines for what is, you know, poised to go forward in New York State, in other words, the government and the governor and the State Department of Environmental Conservation are moving ahead with regulations to permit fracking sometime in the near future within New York State. And as you said in the last segment, we have the science on what that's going to do to air quality and health, where really the numbers could be run to portray an accurate picture of the health and economic costs that would ensue from this. But yet that public health analysis is not being done. Now, the other big, big ticket item, which you pointed out, due to the slowness of science, we don't really have the science on it all yet. So another case, in terms of air, we can do an assessment. In terms of water, we need to do more science before we can do a complete assessment, even though precaution dictates that we not take those health risks with a major population. One of the things that I think some people derive some sense of false assurance. I mean, maybe I'm not in Manhattan, but I'm in Brooklyn, but I often hear people don't even understand that we're not still operating, that we don't have a ban in New York State. They don't even realize that these that fracking is poised to go forward in New York State. But another thing is that people take assurance from, you know, governmental leaders. You know, Governor Cuomo has said, oh, we'll not drill immediately right next to upstate New York water reservoir, even though, you know, there's some disagreement about how far away would be safe, or whether far away would be safe any distance away would actually be sufficient to protect the water supply. So if you as a biologist were kind of, I know this is a bit of a hardball question, but if you were designing what it would take to really study what the health impacts would be and the environmental risks would be in terms of the water supply, in terms of drilling, you know, will it cut it just to not drill right near the reservoir? If not, why not? And what do we need to know to really make that assessment?
Yeah. Well, it's a really great question. In fact, I think that's the key question. And I guess before I launch into it, it occurred to me that you're providing your listeners so many good sources of information for more, you know, in-depth study of this. I'll just throw out one
please.
More. The Facebook page for my book, Raising Elijah, has become a kind of forum of scientific information on fracking. So if anyone wants to go to Raising Elijah by Sandra Steingraber on Facebook, they'll see a lot of documentation there, including two letters, of which I'm signatories of both, one from 250 different public health officials and members of the medical community, physicians and pediatricians, who have urged Governor Cuomo to not move forward any more with fracking plans until the human health assessment is done. So the full analysis of why we shouldn't move forward and the failure to do a human health assessment is in that letter. And then there's a new letter from the cancer advocacy community representing 19 different breast, ovarian cancer groups, young people with cancer groups across New York State who have signed a letter saying, you know what, we don't need any more data points in New York's cancer registry. We have got the 11th, we ranked number 11 in cancer already, so we need to not go forward until we study human health assessments. So Raising Elijah by Sandra Steingraber on Facebook is the place to go to read those letters and other documents on human health effects. Okay, so you asked me a really good question about what we know about New York City's drinking water and how it might be vulnerable. And so here are a few things that we in the scientific community have concerns about. One is that the water for New York City comes not just from any one place in the Catskills, right? It's drawn from a number of different sources, and one of those places is the Delaware River Basin. And the infrastructure that carries that water is actually quite old. It's kind of a beautiful infrastructure, but it's aging and it's leaking. And so the question is, if it's leaky, then, and what we know that water is leaving the pipes, that means there's potential for other things to get into the pipes. And how far away is far enough? How far could contaminants travel through deep geological strata? How could they move through fissures and cracks and joints already in the bedrock to the place where it could influence the water in New York's drinking water? And there's an incredible number of uncertainties about that, and the uncertainties come from a number of sources. One of them is the emerging concern that that fracturing is linked to earthquakes. And I'm actually officially agnostic on this. I'm not convinced that it does, and I'm not convinced that it doesn't. But one thing that we know is true is that when you turn solid bedrock into rubble and you pump it full of fluid, and that fluid contains in it chemicals that are designed to reduce friction, because that's how you get the gas bubbles out of the shale, you make it more likely that those broken up rock formations can slip past each other and be associated with seismic events. And we have some information from across the Atlantic where the conclusion was that fracking or the injection of fracking wastewater into deep geological strata is maybe linked to earthquakes. Now, there's I'm not convinced that is the case. But do we really want to use New York's drinking water as the test to find out whether or not that could happen? So there's that. And then there's this piece of it. You know, we're spending millions of dollars right now, to our great credit as the state of New York, removing a carcinogen from our mightiest, most beloved river, the Hudson. And what we know about the transformation of the Hudson River into the world's largest Superfund site is that a company, General Electric, had been using PCBs, which we know is a human carcinogen, in the manufacture of its equipment. And in the process of doing that, they got into the Hudson River. Well, how did they get there? Well, one way was that they were simply dumped, and GE admits this. And so we're engaged in this dredging process to kind of get all these PCBs out of the bottom of the river and sequestered somewhere. It's not a perfect solution, but it's the best idea we have, because if we do nothing, you know, for many, many generations, we're going to be seeding carcinogens from the sediments of that river into the air, and they'll go into the flesh of fish and so forth. So we've got to move forward. But General Electric has argued, and that some of this cleanup is not really going to solve the problem, because some of the PCBs were actually seeding themselves into the sediments of the Hudson from the bedrock itself. In other words, some of the PCBs went through the factory floor into the bedrock shale, through the fissures and cracks of the shale, and are now emerging through the rock into the river. And there's an underground pool of PCBs moving in this way that, you know, you can dredge all you want, but they're just going to keep seeding themselves through the, you know, through the rock itself. And so if that's true, then how does that compare with what the oil and gas industry are telling us, that the chemicals can't move through shale? You know, shale is inherently fissured and fractured. If PCBs, which are a chemical of pretty high molecular weight, can move through shale, then don't we need to use that terrible experiment, the contamination of all the knowledge we've learned about the contamination of the Hudson River, shouldn't we use that knowledge to say, wait a minute, what are we doing with the Delaware River? Now, when I've argued this point, and for example, at Cornell University Law School, when I was in a debate with the oil and gas industry, I was accused of comparing apples with oranges. And in some ways, that's a you know, I appreciate that criticism. That's correct. the move of PCBs through shale into the Hudson, that's an entirely different hydrological system than the Delaware or the Catskills. But the point is, it's the Earth. It's not a perfect controlled human experiment. It's not a laboratory. So shouldn't you use the knowledge that you already have and to try to make some kind of prediction as to what will happen? And when you use that knowledge, should you not err on the side of caution, especially when, in the case of the Delaware River Basin, that's the source of drinking water for 15 million people? So, you know, as a biologist, I'm really conservative. I don't like to speak beyond the data, but as a cancer survivor and as a mother, I'm conservative in another way, which is to say that if we have any reason to suspect that this is an inherently dangerous situation and millions of people may be in harm's way, then the conservative thing to do is to proceed with extreme caution, which means to stop moving forward until we can study this really thoroughly.
You know, that to me, that sounds like a very compelling argument, because it's basically either, I mean, from what you're describing, it's either, you know, we kind of cross our, if we follow, you know, the gas company protocol here, because we don't have the definitive scientific research of that specific body, we neither, of water, we neither wait for it or do the work instead to do the kind of assessment that you're describing that would allow an accurate assessment. Instead, we just cross our fingers and have faith. Which, you know, that seems to be a very, I mean, it's almost crazy, really, to suggest that.
Well, I think the Hudson River is a cautionary tale, right? I mean, here we have this basically unfixable problem. I mean, we're doing the best we can. It's going to cost billions of dollars. But we ruined commercial fishing in the Hudson for generations of people. We took what used to be a very good protein source of food right there, local fish, for people in New York City, but they can't eat it anymore. And we ruined it, and we now understand, now that it's ruined, how complicated that hydrological system is. We're going to dredge it, we're going to spend billions of dollars, and it's not going to be perfect, and we're not going to get every molecule PCBs out, but it's better than doing nothing. So isn't there a lesson in the story of the Hudson for us now, when we're about ready to put some other inherently toxic chemicals in shale bedrock? And I think there is. I mean, you know, apples to oranges, you know, accusations notwithstanding. We shouldn't pretend that we haven't learned something from that and apply it as best we can to our current situation. Let me, for listeners, kind of paint a picture of the Marcellus Shale, because I think that part of the problem, part of the sort of unknowing of New Yorkers about how we're actually standing in the crosshairs of this energy industry is actually an inability to visualize what we're talking about when we say shale. So one of my jobs as a science writer, I feel like, is to peel back the layer of the earth and try to make my readers look down into a landscape that they really can't see. The integrity of this landscape below our feet is really our well-being here at the sunlit surface is really interconnected with those rocks. So essentially, here's the story of the Marcellus in a few sentences. 400 million years ago or so, this whole area of the Northeast was covered in a shallow ocean. And there was a big range of mountains where the Catskills are now, and those mountains have entirely eroded, and they eroded into the shallow sea. And so they deposited all their silt and also all their elements, including some of the radioactive ones like uranium and strontium and radium and radon and so forth. Those also fell with the silt. Dust, you know, changes its name to silt when it's in water. And they settled on the bottom of this ocean, which was very still. There wasn't a lot of tides, and so there were lots and lots of layers of silt and lots of elements trapped inside the silt. And this was at a time when there wasn't even any land plants yet. So there weren't any, you know, there were no creatures with backbones, nobody had lungs or breasts. It was a long time ago. So there wasn't as much oxygen in the atmosphere as there is now. But there were some plankton, so there was a sort of ecosystem in this ocean, and there were creatures who lived there. But when they died and their bodies sunk down into that silt, there wasn't enough oxygen to decompose them, so they turned into bubbles of methane. So in the silt with all these elements and radioactivity then became trapped bubbles of methane, like a kind of petrified fizz of champagne bubbles in rock. And with pressure, then all that sediment turned into, you know, was pressed into a solid form that we call shale. All right, so, and then it kind of kept getting buried and buried and buried. So now we're a mile above that layer of shale, but it contains a sort of petrified bunch of bubbles. And so it's really a graveyard of squids and sea lilies. That's what those bubbles of methane, those are the creatures that they used to represent. But that shale layer, is true for all deep geological strata, is actually a living ecosystem. It's alive. There are creatures that live at that depth. Geologists call them deep life. So one of the reasons that fracking fluid is so toxic is because it contains biocides. These are very powerful cellular poisons that are used after we blow up this bedrock, that we're pumping poison into it to kill off the organisms that live at that depth, which are using the carbon in the methane for their fuel source. Or in some cases, deep life forms can use, you know, radioactive decay. They can run on hydrogen. They have all kinds of really wild alternative ways of living.
That's really amazing. You're drawing such a beautiful picture, and I just want to say we only have a few more minutes here. And
some of the, of course, the living organisms come from the ponds and the lakes and the streams where we're drawing the fracking fluid, and so we're also pumping those underground. But the point is that the gas industry recognizes that when those organisms grow, they plug up the pipes. This is called biofouling, and so that's why the powerful poisons have to be deployed. And here's what we don't know. So the uncertainty of all this includes the fact that deep life organisms actually, geologists now believe that there are more, by biomass, there are more organisms in deep geological strata than there are here at the surface. So in other words, the biosphere of our planet extends very far down into the dark heart of the Earth, far closer to the magma core than we ever thought possible. And what that means is that these organisms, because they're metabolically active, almost certainly play a role in element cycling and no doubt in carbon cycling.
You know, Sandra, I just want to say, if you can hear me, that we just have a few more minutes. So, you know, if we can kind of, you know, we created that big picture, but if we can kind of sum it up for people so that we can get the full picture before we have to get off the air.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. So, in other words, these rocks are maybe part of what helps stabilize our climate, and their integrity may play a role in our integrity. So I think we've gotten very good at looking up in the sky and realizing that the ozone hole way up there actually has something to do with how well we're doing down here. But we haven't gotten good at looking down below our feet and saying, you know what, that ecosystem down there also has something to do with us up here. We're connected. And with fracking, we're just destroying that before we understand it. So that's like Donald Rumsfeld might call the unknown unknown, right? But this is what we're playing with when we're playing with fracking.
So in other words, there's a lot going on. So does that translate into the fact that in addition to the destruction of life, there can be, you know, kind of flow into water aquifers or destabilizations that, you know, impact water and the integrity of Earth in ways that we don't understand? I mean, how does that kind of, for the New York City resident living downstream wondering about their water supply, how does, you know, what's the takeaway on that?
I don't know if there is one. I don't think that's even part of the debate yet. And so my point is only that there's things that we know for sure that will happen to New Yorkers, such as increased air pollution that will come, you know, be blown in from upstate and from Pennsylvania to the cities. But there are also things that we have no idea about that could be the consequences. You know, we didn't have any idea that PCBs could actually squeak their way through shale bedrock into the Hudson. Now that we did that experiment with the Hudson, we now know, and we're faced with a terrible cleanup. So do we really want to put in motion another uncontrolled experiment? Because when you shatter the bedrock underneath our feet, you can't fix it. It's not even like the deep sea oil drilling where eventually we could at least plug the hole sooner or later, you know.
Not that we maybe have or have not. That's a debatable question as well. Well, thank you. I mean, I guess my takeaway from that is that the bedrock isn't, you know, just a solid entity that isn't vulnerable if we start playing around with it in this weird way.
It's not inert, right? It's seismically active. It's, you know, metabolically active. It's radioactive. So there are a lot of bad things down there in the earth, and as long as the bedrock is intact, they don't have a way to reach us here. But when you start to shatter it and pump it full of toxins, then it's a little bit like opening a chemical Pandora's box.
So let's keep Pandora's box shut. Thank you so much,
Sandra
Steingraber. It's just been a pleasure having you on the show, sharing your wisdom, and thank you for your donation of your Heinz Award and for all your brilliant writing and public speaking and advocacy. It's just been
a delight. Well, I don't think fracking is a foregone conclusion in New York. I mean, the industry always acts like, you know, it's only a matter of time and that resistance is futile. I don't believe that. I mean, as a cancer survivor, you know, my adoptive mother and I had cancer together. She always said, don't let them bury you until you're dead. We haven't started fracking yet.
We've had some success, and I think we have more coming in really raising public awareness and outcry on this. And,
exactly.
And politicians are listening. They listened in Delaware, and we have a stall right now. So I do urge listeners to read Raising Elijah, to get active, and to tune in next week to Connect the Dots at noon Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Thank you for being with us. I'm Allison Rose Levy.